So lecture 23, April 12th, lecture notes page 212. Looks like it's spring outside in northeast Ohio. It'll probably snow again sometime, you're right.
Yeah.
I did hit record. Face coverage required for all cabs, everyone in classroom, on so some. Mask, 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 mask. Mask. Thank you. By the way, I don't know if you heard or not, Philadelphia, as of Monday, is reinstituting their indoor mask requirements. So waves are going up and down. At the same time, I think the government said that Monday, unless they change the rules, they're supposed to drop masks for transportation, but I suspect that may be on hold. Well, yeah, follow the science. We know that this is an opportunity to earn summer money with DKS. We've seen that before. We know that you can attend the CB Pitch Finest on April 21st. This is just interesting because we have so many fashion students, and it's sort of interesting in general. The KSU Fashion Show is back, April 28th through 30th. Opening night show Thursday, 28th, 7 p.m., open to the public, etc. If you're interested in any of that, www.kent.edu/fashionshow. Or call the box office. Anybody participating in that by any chance? Maybe that's later on in the fashion program. So we're getting near the end of the course. Here's an opportunity to earn some that little bit of extra credit you're going to need to push you up into the A-plus category. This is reward for doing something you should do anyhow. We always encourage you to fill out your flash survey course evaluations. And in general, you should receive an email from Flash Survey. However, I have also added a link to make it really easy on the course homepage on Canvas, McGraw-Hill Connect, course evaluations, all right? Because evaluation is anonymous, I can't award extra credit for your individual participation, but a while ago I invented this idea of giving you extra credit based on what percentage of the overall class participates. So I will award extra credit points for participation as follows. I'll award up to 0.5%. Again, not important, I guess, unless you're at the margin, in which case it's really important, and by the way, go help somebody else, based on the overall class participation by Wednesday, May 4th at 11:59 p.m. So, if 100% of the class participates by then, everyone will earn 0.5% added to their final course grade. That's a fair deal for doing something you should be doing anyhow, yeah? Yeah. If 75% of students participate, everyone will have 0.375% added to their final course grade. That's 0.75 times 0.5. Or if 50% participate, everyone will earn 0.25%. So that's a little bump. Help yourselves out. Help other people out? Yeah. So, let's play an over-under game. How many people think that using this device over the semesters I've gotten better than 90% participation? Better than 80%? Better than 70%? Better than 60%? 50%? 40%? Better than 30%? This usually bumps it up to about 33%. You guys could do better than that, I bet. So feel free to participate in all courses, but in mine as well. Extra credit number 9, closing Thursday. Mini test number 11, closing tonight. And midterm number 2, closing tomorrow. It's going to turn itself off at 5 p.m., so be done with it by 5 p.m. I've said that a lot by now. Any questions on the midterm? So there it is on the calendar. There's... We're doing lecture 23 today, mini test 11 closing, midterm 2 closing, etc. So far, the current average is 72%. We have a lot of students who haven't taken it yet. I'm pretty sure that average will go down. I will, as always, add I'll add curve to bring it up to about that value as necessary. Enhanced learning extra credit, closing Thursday. All right. So, I find it amusing when I self-reflect, when anything comes up about Starbucks, I get overly long and elaborate, and that happened again here in today's Business in the News, where Howard Schultz is coming back as the CEO again, and I find it so interesting that there are too many slides here. But you got to put up with me because I think it's interesting. So, on his first day back as CEO of Starbucks, again, Howard Schultz made a highly controversial $20 billion decision. On Monday, April 4th, Howard Schultz returned to Starbucks as its CEO for the third time. This went after Kevin Johnson, who was appointed CEO in 2017, announced last month that he was retiring. So a bit about corporate leadership at the business level. While Schultz has made it clear that he intends to hold the role only on an interim basis, he wasted no time in making significant change. In a letter to employees, Schultz said the company was canceling its plans to buy back $20 billion of its stock over the next few years. My finance students, this would obviously tie into financial arrangements of the firm and how it affects the shareholder stockholders' value. Starting immediately, we're suspending our share repurchasing program. This decision will allow us to invest more profit into our people and our stores. The only way to create long-term value for all stakeholders. A good business strategy, I think, and a good marketing strategy. By the way, what negative, controversial thing has been happening with Starbucks recently before we get to it in the slides? Anybody know what's been going on? Controversial, negative-ish with the employees? Unionization at the store level. Usually, when employees call for unions, it means you haven't been treating them right. And rather than spending money on your shareholders, how about if you spend it on your employees? That's Schultz for you. I'm not in business as a shareholder of Starbucks to make every single decision based on the stock price for the quarter, said Schultz. Now, Wall Street did respond in turn, sending the shares down 3.7%. But he's planning for long-term success, not for the profit in the quarter. Bless him. Schultz is inheriting a company that looks different than the one that he left 5 years ago. Employees have stepped up efforts to unionize as they criticize the way they're treated by the company, especially during the pandemic. To date, 11 stores have voted to form unions, including the company's flagship roastery in the Chelsea neighbor of New York City. So do you remember what we said about the importance of treating people right when we talked about our services triangle? Company management has to set the service promise for the customers. Company management has to make sure that its people enable the service promise by treating employees right, because it's those employees that deliver the service to the customers. And we don't think Starbucks has been doing a bang-up job of that recently. So, some of the primary complaints center on employees' pay and working conditions. It's no coincidence that the two things Schultz mentioned the company plans to do with the $20 billion are investing in its people and its stores. So let's invest to enable the delivery of the service promise, as we talked about with our little triangle. In the long run, investing in its people benefits everyone. Employees benefit when they feel valued and are compensated fairly for the work they do. Starbucks benefits by earning back trust and fixing the broken relationship. Shareholders benefit too, especially if the company is able to head off further efforts to unionize stores, something investors fear will jeopardize the company's reputation. Committing to spending $20 billion on employees instead of handing money back to shareholders seems like the type of thing that can make a real difference, even if it's sure to be controversial. So what are some challenges he's going to face? Well, as you may recall, I don't know how far back you can picture Starbucks, the original idea was just going to be the third place between office and home, someplace you could go, have a cup of coffee, relax, maybe do a little work, was the original idea. But many customers today are no longer interested in that idea of a third place. So we see the idea of changing customer values. Around 70% of all U.S. Starbucks orders are now to go, with hundreds of traditional U.S. stores reformatted in recent years as takeaway-oriented locations. COVID-19 and widespread staffing shortages have made getting drinks and food out the door harder. A coffee drinker in the Beverly Hills, California area said, look, the lines and wait times have grown longer at his local Starbucks locations. He says, I'm not picking up beverages at the chain anymore. I gave up on Starbucks. Not good. A Starbucks spokeswoman said that the company wants to provide the best experience possible for customers and is focused now on elevating it. So the need to deliver on the promise. Starbucks barista's job is now different than what it was originally, and many of them aren't happy. Working at a Starbucks nowadays can be a juggling act. Workers have to manage orders coming in through drive-through windows, mobile phones, and over the countertop. A challenge for employees who are also scored on their ability to connect with customers. So here's the need for the company to adapt to changing consumer needs, wants, and desires, and the challenges they're finding in doing that. Hannah Scott, a shift supervisor in a Buffalo cafe, said baristas often feel overwhelmed at peak hours. As to what she would like to see Mr. Schultz do, Ms. Scott said, I'm hoping to listen more to the employees. So back to our service triangle and the importance of communicating with the employees. Investors are growing frustrated too. She'll test to deal with that. Starbucks shares fell 16% over the past 12 months, pressured by what analysts have said are concerns over rising costs. Everybody's facing that, as well as the impact of pandemic-driven restrictions challenging operations in China. Investors are asking about Mr. Schultz's plan to improve worker retention and store operations and what that might cost. The question is, what are the resources that are going to be needed to fix it? Starbucks told investors it aims to get store profit margins back to the previous levels by 2024. Higher costs for everything from barista training to trucking costs are squeezing the company, and competition is increasing. Suppliers are charging more for products while wages are sharply up for restaurant workers. We've been talking about the relationship between costs and revenue and profit, and when all those costs are going up, something's got to give. Something's going to be squeezed. The company has pledged to increase average wages to $17 an hour. How many of you guys work part-time or whatever? How many of you guys are earning as much as 17 bucks an hour? Couple. Okay, so pretty good salary for a barista, I guess, but maybe not the highest around. While paying more for ingredients, supplies, and trainings, the chain has at times struggled with shortages of key materials during the pandemic, including they didn't have enough cups at one point in time. The company also faces more competition for the consumer's coffee habits from artisanal coffee shops, as well as expanding chains such as Dunkin' and Dutch Brothers, some of which are also catering to demand for coffee on the go with drive-thrus and mobile orders. So here's the impact of those crest factors, competition, economics, on business and marketing. Bringing customers back to Starbucks urban stores remains a work in progress. Companies are reopening downtown offices, a chance for Starbucks to reclaim coffee sales among workers who brewed up their coffee at home for the past 2 years, so adapting to that change. And geopolitical uncertainties in Ukraine, Russia, and China, all messing with Starbucks' growth plans. Expansion beyond the U.S. has long been a part of Starbucks' strategy. Around 75% of the 2,000 stores it intends to add this year will come outside the U.S., so Schultz has to pursue that growth on a rapidly shifting geopolitical map. Challenges of global marketing, challenges of Russia's war on Ukraine. After closing 130 licensed stores in Russia in March, after that country invaded Ukraine, Starbucks hasn't said when or if its Russian operations might restart. Company is dealing with other challenges in China due to pandemic restrictions. What if Starbucks' first price increases this year sparked consumer backlash in China after Starbucks implemented it in February in response to rising costs? People don't like price increases. In a note to employees last month, Mr. Schultz said the situation in Ukraine and the pandemic demonstrated why Starbucks needed to be a welcoming place for all people. This has never been more needed, he wrote. And I note, Starbucks' mission is stated as to inspire and nurture the human spirit, one person, one cup, and one neighborhood at a time. Hard to do the mission in these situations. We'll see if Schultz has success. Coke has a new flavor, and it's a weird one. Coke is quickly building on its creations platform. That platform seeks to push new flavors out to the market on a rolling basis. The strategy underpins how large food and beverage brands are reworking the ways that they insert themselves into consumers' culture, including categories like gaming, where enthusiasts often express an aversion to ad-supported media, adapting marketing to current consumers. Rather than enact a months-long media campaign for a new permanent flavor that they're going to add that may or may not stick, Creations is dedicated to limited rollouts that emphasize tailored digital and real-world experiences. The quick-hit approach follows Coke culling a large portion of its beverage portfolio. So agile marketing, changing the product mix. In line with the larger Creations mandate, Zero Sugar Bite, the new flavor, embodies a concept rather than a traditional flavor like cherry vanilla. Starlight, the first, weren't you the guy telling me about Starlight? Starlight, the first soda produced from the initiative, was space flavored, capitalized on renewed interest in space travel, driven by companies like SpaceX and Blue Origin. The new limited edition drink, which carried a distinctive sensation, I guess that's the previous one, was available at retailers starting late in February and included an augmented reality performance from pop singer Ava Max that can be accessed by scanning a QR code on the packaging, so getting fan involvement. The new one, Zero Sugar Bite, shows Coke iterating on aspects of Starlight while trying to offer something fresh. Like Starlight, the pixel-themed beverage has unique packaging, bearing lettering recalling the blocky graphic styles of vintage video games. Zero Sugar Byte will also feature a scannable label that links out to an AR game. Coke, so that's the product side of things. Coke, at the same time, is layering in a metaverse component through the bespoke island in Fortnite. Anybody still playing Fortnite? Fortnite players? Anybody ever play Fortnite?
I never started. My brother did.
Okay. Well, you can give him the special Pixel Point code. There you go. And get him onto the special Pixel Point out at Fortnite, where they have a special island, which has a neon-tinged isometric aesthetic resembling Tron, includes activities like a race through bubbles and a castle defense game. The access code is that. So cozying up to gamers remains one of Coke's biggest agenda items. So we see target marketing, technology, the metaverse, and marketing. Who knows Coachella? Anybody ever been to Coachella? So yeah, so my kid is going to Coachella, not the main part of the story. He's in between jobs right now, about to start a brand new job, but he got a break, and he got all signed up for Coachella because it was all in the excitement of the moment, and then he realized he didn't know any of the people in playing at Coachella. Not the main point of the conversation. So, Absolut Vodka brings Coachella to the metaverse. Absolut Vodka is bringing its Coachella space to... Oh, well, maybe I should back up. Who doesn't know what Coachella is? Okay, so Coachella is a massive... multi-day music concert in the desert, like Palms, outside of LA in Palm Springs, attended by a kajillion people in this outdoor concert venue. It's bringing Coachella space to the metaverse in a mix of virtual and real-life experiential marketing. So we're seeing technology and marketing, we're seeing event marketing, we're seeing experiential marketing, and of course this is a sales promotion event for them as well. The liquor brand will recreate its festival experience in Decentraland, which is a 3D virtual world browser-based platform, allowing players and festival attendees to interact with each other. The metaverse experience, known as Absolut.land, would have three floors with 10 interactive elements. So we're seeing technology and marketing, experiential marketing, getting consumers involved. Those three floors include allowing players to collect NFT wearables, receive discount codes for cocktail kits, and possibly win tickets to the second weekend of Coachella. Festival attendees in real life will be able to create their own avatar, kiosks, gift NFT wearables, and try them on using QR codes. So technology and marketing at work, experiential marketing work, getting fan involvement through this approach. This is our first foray into the metaverse. So our goal is to test and learn over the next 2 weeks, says Pam Forbes. We've created 10 virtual experiences to see what our customers like. So they're testing new concepts in real time at this event. The NFT virtual fashions will come from three lines inspired by Pride, the metaverse, and Coachella. The brand partnered with Susan Alexandra, a designer known for her handbags and jewelry, to make her accessories into limited edition NFTs. So there are some examples of the NFTs available. Is this the future of fashion? We think the metaverse will be the next wave of how people socialize, Forbes said. While it may not be comfortable for me, it is for my Gen Z kids. We're excited to see how the space evolves and how we can make it a place where it's easy for people to get together. So, players can visit the Decentraland experience at absolutland.com and must be 21 years of age or older to enter. A year ago or so, we weren't talking at all about the metaverse as a marketing tool. Now it's everywhere. There's a great one going on where Discovery is pairing up with Legos to create a new kid-safe metaverse, something like that. All right, back to the boring stuff. We pick up with lecture notes, page 212, page 384 in the textbook, chapter 14, arriving at the final price. And I'll try to get your report for my kid on Coachella. So we were looking at the last step in our setting our final price. That was special adjustments to the Lister quoted price. And we ended up with geographic adjustments, okay? So one approach, which you may have seen somewhere in your business literature, whatever, is called FOB origin or free on board origin. In this case, and we're mostly talking B2B or really big objects here, the shipping cost from the factory or the warehouse is paid for by the buyer. So here I've given you my price, and then you've got to pay the shipping cost from my factory or from my warehouse. So obviously, if you're real close to wherever I am, your shipping price is relatively small. And if you're clean across the country and this is some massive object you purchased from me, your price is going to be a lot higher than the guy who's closest. So different buyers will pay different shipping costs. In this situation, FOB origin, ownership of the goods is transferred to the buyer as soon as it leaves the point of origin. Why is that important? Why is it important who owns the product when? Don't scratch your mask, I'm gonna think you're asking, you're answering. Why would it be important who owns the, you guys, anybody? Why would it be important who owns the product when? Yeah. Yeah, but I could know that either way, right? So, that would be helpful, but I think I could know it either way.
Liability.
What happens if that product is damaged? During travel? What if it goes out of fashion or style? What if it's stolen? Who has liability? Who has responsibility for that? You better know that if you bought a product and it's being shipped FOB origin, it's yours. Now, since it's yours, the buyer, can't make the arrangements for the shipping, the transportation, or I might be a nice guy and say, okay, it's yours, but I can arrange for the transportation for you if you like. You're paying, I'll arrange for it. What? Okay, that's better. So here we see the seller, we see the title transfer at the seller's dock. It's the buyer's good until the buyer gets it in transportation. So a uniform delivery pricing system, in this case the shipping cost from the factory or warehouse is included in the selling price, okay? In this case, ownership of the goods is not transferred to the buyer until it is delivered to the buyer. And the seller, since they own the good, arranges for transportation. One approach to this geographic adjustment is to have single zone pricing. So the same price is charged to all buyers regardless of their location. I don't know if I know anymore what a first class stamp costs. But whatever it is, the cost of the stamp is the same whether you send something from Kent to Kent or Kent to California. That's the equivalent of a single zone pricing system, yeah? On the other hand, you might choose to go with a multiple zone pricing scheme where prices increase as the shipping distances increase. Again, large, bulky items that are heavy and difficult to work with. Sometimes we do this by drawing concentric circles on a map. The plant or the warehouse is at the middle, and then we have zone 1, zone 2, zone 3. Or, again, if this is a really difficult thing to ship, maybe instead of using circles, we'll draw irregularly shaped place boundaries that reflect geography, population density, transportation infrastructure, shipping costs. So there might be a different approach to use this multiple zone pricing. So here's an example where we have a zone pricing system. So our Cleveland plant is the center of the zone, and our base price for this product is $100. And if you live in zone 1, your shipping cost is an additional $10. So $110, right? If you are in zone 2, St. Louis, for example, the shipping is $20. So a St. Louis customer pays $120, whereas a Chicago or Cleveland or Pittsburgh customer pays $110. And if you're in zone 3, then you pay $30 shipping. So LA and Seattle both pay $30 shipping, so your cost is $130. Yeah? So multiple zone pricing. In some situations, we have multiple warehouses, we have multiple manufacturing plants, so we might have a basing point pricing system. So certain cities where we have warehouses, where we have plants, are designated as the basing point. So all goods that are shipped from a given basis point are charged the same amount, no matter how near or far they are from that base city. So in this case, we have an example. It's the same. It's a company that has a basing point in St. Louis, and the St. Louis plant basing point is $120 price to all, regardless of the actual freight. So even though it's $20 to ship it to LA and $30 to ship it to Seattle and $10 to ship it to Chicago, we're going to charge everybody $120 from that base point. Okay, so it depends what goes on with your competition, your customers, what's expected, what the industry is doing. Freight absorption pricing. In this case, the seller agrees to absorb all or part of the cost of the transportation. So we can use this as a promotional tactic. So especially during maybe the Christmas season, you'll see for the B2C world, we'll ship this good. If you purchase it before December 2nd, free shipping to move you along to buy the product. The seller might reason that if they can get more business, its average cost will decrease, we've talked about that before, and more than compensate for its extra freight cost that it is absorbing. This pricing is often used for market penetration and to hold on in increasingly competitive markets against the competition. That might work for you as well. Until recently, once we set a price, it pretty much stayed in place. The internet, computers, algorithms have changed that. So now we have a new way of thinking about pricing, personalized, dynamic pricing. So until recently, most prices, once set, remained pretty consistent for some time period. But with digital advances, there are more opportunities to adjust prices to reflect the value of the experience to the customer at any time of the year, any time of the month, any day of the week, any hour of the day. We can adjust prices on our internet site. Companies like Amazon can and do monitor prices 24/7. They have a huge amount of information to work with, and they can correlate that information and make faster and more granular price adjustments than we've ever been able to see before. So, how do we build dynamic pricing into our customer experience? We should take 6 actions. First of all, this is a whole different way of thinking about things. So we should adopt a new pricing mindset. Rather than just thinking about aligning price to the product alone and the cost of that product, recognize that price is a reflection and quantifiable measure of the customer experience. As the customer experience changes, so should the price that's attached to it. We may not even know why consumers are suddenly willing to pay more for something, but we might observe on the internet, companies are charging more, people are paying more, we should get on board. I don't know why they're doing it, but maybe I should be involved in it. As opposed to, well, we need a X percent profit, let's just charge this. Walk in the customer's shoes. Consider all the factors that influence the buying experience, as well as the potential effects that a change in the sales context might have on customers' expectations. At the same time, identify the data sources that enable a deeper appreciation of buyers' lives, the environment in which they live, the issues that they face, their moods or mindset at the point of sale. Armed with those insights, segment customers more precisely and more empathetically, and create a product pricing offer that best meets their needs. Harmonize pricing experience. Gain affinity and grow revenue by fairly correlating prices with the level of experience that's offered in different channels. This may involve reconsidering the channel strategy that you use. And, for example, creating online brands to reach consumers who are more interested in reliable supply or lower price than they are in the shopping experience. But make sure that your offline and online experiences work to complement, not to contradict each other. So to be silly about it, my wife, who likes Saks Fifth Avenue, likes shopping in store, likes trying things on, likes customer service, is not going to be really enticed to see Saks Fifth Avenue discount online. She'll buy Saks Fifth Avenue online, but she doesn't expect it to be a discounted version, right? She wants consistency in what she's getting. Build the right team, invest in building the skills needed to convert data into prices and experiences that customers want and are willing to pay for. Focus on executional excellence. Speed is a critical component of dynamic pricing. Make sure the feedback mechanisms are in place to enable fast price changes. Accuracy is also important. Invest in the right tools and technologies to make this happen. And build agility, marketing agility, into the organization. Experiences, consumer experiences, are liquid. They change. So if you have this approach, prices have to be liquid too. They have to change. The organization that enables this fluidity has to be liquid too. Break down barriers that often stymie the delivery of high-quality consumer experience by making sure that marketing, supply chain, customer service, financing, logistics, and other areas are aligned to the dynamic pricing strategy. Sales and marketing leaders have long known that price and experience are intricately bound together. Consumer packaged goods that adopt dynamic pricing will be able to compete in entirely new ways and use customer affinity to drive growth. With pricing that accurately and fairly reflects the value of the consumer shopping experience, they create mutually beneficial outcomes for themselves and their consumers. So let's take a peek at this example. We're looking at three retailers of a product, a microwave oven, the GE Profile 120. Here's Amazon, here's Best Buy, and here's Sales. So retailers are adjusting prices on everyday items several times a day. Here's a look at the GE microwave for three web e-tailers. So what do we see? We see at the start of the day, Amazon is selling it for $744.46. At the start of the day, Best Buy is selling it at $809.99. And Sears is selling it at $899.99. In this example, Sears is not really attuned to dynamic pricing and to watching to see what's going on with the customer experience and when they might want it. So at the beginning of the day, Sears is at $8.99. At the end of the day, Sears is at $8.99. They're not being very dynamic. Amazon is paying attention to what the consumer demand looks like and what people are buying and what's going on. They start at 7:44 at 5 in the morning. I have no idea why that. They jump it up to above Amazon's, Best Buy's price. They sell it for a while there. Again, I don't know the underlying reason. But then at 9 a.m., they drop it back down to their 7:44 price. That goes on a while till people get online shopping at noon on lunch break. They jump it back up. They move it around. It eventually comes down. So Amazon has run 9 price changes in that time period. Best Buy, a little slower on the uptake, but still doing some dynamic pricing, runs along at 809, presently jumps up late in the day to Sears price, runs for there until 1 in the morning, and drops back down. They are not doing it randomly. They're doing it based on the algorithms that they have running and their ability to make those adjustments. Yeah? Why should we be engaged in dynamic pricing? So beyond the point where costs have been covered, as the number of price points relative to an existing fixed price level increase, so do the potential profits. So in our example, here's our cost, here's our single selling price, and so this is our profit picture. What if we could sell some down here with different price changes? Nah, we're just going to let that go. We aren't going to make those changes. We aren't going to pick up that additional profit. Here we have our cost. We have our first selling price. And then we find that at another selling price, we pick up additional sales. And so we have additional profit. So to the extent that your algorithm works right, you can follow what's going on. Consumers are willing to pay the additional higher or lower prices. You're able to pick up additional profit. This video does a little explanation of how it works at Amazon. See if you can make some sense out of it.
Amazon's tremendous success in many ways foots back to the reputation it has earned as a low-cost player in the retail world. 95% of beauty products are priced lower on Amazon than any other online retailer. The same is true for 90% of hair care products and even 81% of low-margin personal care products. Amazon keeps its prices low through a variety of mechanisms. A key component about the platform is that both Amazon itself can sell its own inventory and millions of third-party merchants can sell theirs on the same platform. Amazon prices its inventory using a unique price-matching crawler that scans e-tailers across the web to find the lowest prices for a product. Amazon then uses this information to price its own products to ensure that it is always offering the lowest prices. Amazon is currently estimated to adjust its prices more than 2.5 million times per day. It does this for products of both brands that have chosen to officially distribute on Amazon, such as Procter & Gamble's Olay, as well as those who have not, for example, Estee Lauder. Amazon's third-party marketplace also ensures that prices stay low on the platform. A key component is that multiple merchants can sell the same product. These merchants, however, have to compete to win the buy box on a listing. Amazon's buy box algorithm considers many seller factors when trying to decide who wins a listing. Many of these are based on past seller performance, such as total sales volume or reviews. However, price is also strongly considered and is the factor over which a third-party merchant has the most immediate influence. A classic invisible hand scenario, the level of competition in a sector, the number of suppliers offering a particular product, is strongly correlated with the average discount available for that product. Third-party pricing on Amazon feeds back into the price crawler that Amazon uses to determine the pricing on its own inventory, so the activity of third-party merchants helps keep Amazon's own prices low.
Okay, so she talks almost as fast as I do, but hopefully you got some sense of what's going on, and they're changing the prices how many times a day to keep up with the changing sentiments of consumers, what the competition is doing, and what they're willing to pay. Price is an interesting concept within the marketing mix because it's an easy way to get into legal trouble. So, how do you get into legal trouble with your pricing? First of all, talk to your competitors and decide what you'll set the price for that product to be. It's called price fixing, and you can go to jail. So, in October 2020, Pilgrim's Pride had to pay $110 million to settle charges of fixing chicken prices with the competition. Also, if you try to enforce specific prices within the channel, that's considered price fixing. This is why you see manufactured suggested retail price. It may never have been sold at that at our store. Now, if you own the channel, then it's your company channel. You can keep the price where you want it to be. But if you're going out to the retailers, you can't tell them what they must sell it at. Price discrimination, charging different prices to buyers when there are no differences in the grade, quality, or cost of the goods, that results in substantial lessening of competition. Didn't we just get done saying on Thursday that that's exactly what happens in the car industry? That different people pay different prices for the exact same product? Why aren't all car dealers called in for price discrimination? Yeah. You and I can buy the same quality car at the dealer and we can be charged different amounts. Why am I not charged as a dealer with price discrimination? Last part of the sentence. That results in a substantial lessening of competition. There's car dealers all over the place, all doing the same thing. We don't find that there's less competition because of this practice, hence they don't run afoul of the law. Engage in deceptive pricing, bait and switch. This is the idea where you say that you can get a flat screen TV for $25. Somebody comes into your store and you say, oh, we just sold out of that. Oh, that was not very good. Here, come buy this one over here. If you have a limited number of products available at a particular price point, state it in your advertising. Don't lie about it. Bargains that are conditioned on purchases of overpriced products, that's deceptive pricing. Fake sales off of prices that are never really offered. That actually goes to my example of a sale off of the manufacturer's suggested retail price with the little phrasing that has to be there. However, our stores may never have covered, may never have sold this at the manufacturer's suggested retail price. So it is 25% off that price. We never actually sold it at that, but at least it's stated. Predatory pricing, low prices to drive out competition and then raise prices. We might ask why Walmart doesn't get charged with predatory pricing. Don't they come into a town, have low prices, and drive out competition? Yeah, they do. But what don't they do? The second part of the sentence. They don't then raise the prices back up. So if you were to flip over to figure 14.9, you see all of these different acts being discussed. And you'll hear more about these in your, I presume, in your business law and legal environment course. So pay attention to that when you go to set your prices. All right, so that's the end of our material on pricing. Takes us to chapter 15. And if I have it right, lecture note, page 215, managing marketing channels and supply chains. So back in our framework for strategic marketing management, we've been started at the 30,000 foot level, worked down to the 20,000 foot level. We're now at the 10,000 foot level. We've talked about products and services. We've talked about pricing. And now we're talking about the other P of the four P's, place. Here we're going to talk about it as distribution, the next P of the marketing mix. So one more time, our marketing mix with the consumer at the middle. We talked about products and services. We talked about price. We're going to talk about promotion. And here we talk about place with the consumer at the center, whether we're talking about B2B or B2C consumers. We all know that supply chains are in a panic. Anybody, by the way, go to see the Drunk Bus showing over the weekend? No? So I went there, and I happened to be going to dinner with some guy that I did not know, and he was involved in the supply chain for, I think, the electric company. I said, I want to talk to you about supply chain. He said to me, you must have heard this before, he said to me, are your lights on? I said, yeah. He said, then your supply chain in the electric area is fine. Supply chain's in a pandemic. The supply chain is how we get nearly all the stuff in our lives that we want to need. It's a system that helps make and deliver our favorite products. It involves the manufacturers of these products, the companies that supply materials to create those products, the cargo ships and trains and trucks, airplanes that deliver them, and the stores that sell them. It is a complex network of various different entities that work together in order to enable us as consumers to receive our products in the time that we expect. As you know, the pandemic has disrupted nearly every aspect of the global supply chain. How many of you guys in the last couple months have gone to the store and not found something where you expected it to be? A bunch of us are still, I mean, you know, it's not all the time, it's not everything, but it's still a problem. I want that thing. It's not there. Many factories, especially in China and South Korea, shut down or were forced to reduce production because workers were sick or in lockdowns. In response, shipping companies cut their schedules in anticipation of a drop in demand for moving goods around the world. That's a terrible mistake because we don't have trucks and drivers available to deliver stuff. Americans took the money they used to spend outside the home and redirected it to goods for their homes, which were suddenly doubling as offices and classrooms. So now there's a steep surge in the demand for those products, and that clogged that system for transporting goods to the factories that needed them. At the same time, finished products, many of them made in China, piled up in warehouses and at ports throughout Asia and the U.S. because of a profound shortage of shipping containers, standard steel-sized boxes that carry goods on the big vessels. At the same time, truck drivers and dock workers were stuck in quarantine, reducing the availability of people to unload goods and further slowing the process. The pandemic has certainly made supply and demand extremely volatile, shifting faster than the supply chain has been able to adjust. So it's resulted in remarkable shifts in supply and demand. Toilet paper, How many people remember the initial pandemic where everybody was running to the store to buy all the toilet paper off the shelves? But the usage of it also shifted. So businesses, hotels, and restaurants were closed, and suddenly people were consuming their own toilet paper at home. Institutional toilet paper, which are different brands and different diameter rolls and different quantities than what you use at home, weren't being purchased, and the retail supply chain wasn't set up for that shift to consumer toilet paper. And people at home wanted some control. They began to hoard toilet paper. A shift in how consumption happens, plus an increase in demand because people are hoarding, resulted in empty toilet paper shelves at the store. Bicycles. Many bikes are made in Japan, but they were under a lockdown in January and February last year, so bikes weren't being made then, so they didn't get shipped to the distribution centers in March and April, so there became a supply shortage there. Add to that, a lot of people were at home, and they wanted to get outside, and so they started bicycling, so the demand for bicycles went up. So there's less supply, a whole lot more demand, and there's a reason why you could walk into a Walmart and not see a single bike on the shelf. The pandemic has resulted in anticipating stock and supply chain issues. Several retailers offered Black Friday 2021 deals early. For instance, Best Buy and Walmart hosted Black Friday deals on tech, home, and fashion. Meanwhile, shoppers could snag Amazon deals on a wide range of products, including the new Apple AirPods, during the retailer's Epic Deals event. During the sale, Amazon had both week-long discounts and one-day sales. So as a result of this, we're going to make changes in terms of what's going on. At least we project that there will be. We assume there's going to be some reshoring of items. You know, we did a lot of offshoring of production. Why did we do that? We were chasing cheaper and cheaper labor. First, a number of years ago, everything moved to Mexico. Then those labor costs began to go up, and everybody shifted to, China. China started going up, and then they chased over to the Philippines or to Indonesia or to Vietnam. At this point, there's some thinking that that may not have been the perfect solution for the world. So we may see reshoring of some items. So move away from focusing on just-in-time and just-in-sequence manufacturing to having it made locally. The shift to online and omnichannel retailing, we'll talk about that in Chapter 17. We'll continue. So curbside pickup, shipping from the store, getting your groceries delivered, that's changing for a lot of firms, and that's going to be something where firms are going to be making investments to allow all this to continue. Supply chains will be going digital, but maybe moving slowly. There was still a lot of paper in supply chains, not toilet paper, regular paper where you're writing stuff down. Invoices and shipping documents, for example, were still done on paper at the start of all this. People had to sign for things, especially in big corporate shipments. That's beginning to shift, but you're going to need people to help manage that, make sure that there's still good control of those kind of things, ITIS, that work. Having a strong, resilient supply chain is really important, as I think we've all noticed recently, and firms are going to be making investments in that. It's going to become more and more visible and hopefully more and more reliable, we'll see. All right. Let's return to a non-pandemic world and think about place, distribution, supply chains. So traditionally, the relationship between the supplier and the merchant, the retailer, were seen as somewhat adversarial in the sense that each entity, the manufacturer, the wholesaler, the retailer, was out for their own best good. They wanted the most profit they could get. They wanted control. Everybody can't make the most profit because nobody's going to buy the product. Everybody can't be in control. So a while ago, Walmart said, look, this is not a good way to go. It's all fighting each other. So this traditional relationship is outmoded, and it's hurting the entire channel, the retailer, the manufacturer. So Walmart is a really big entity, as you know, invited, and I put that in quotes because when Walmart invites you to do something, you ought to show up for the invitation. So they invited their major suppliers to jointly develop powerful supply chain partnerships, a new idea at the time. And they felt that this would increase the product flow efficiency, and consequently, there'd be less waste in the system, and both the manufacturer and they're their own wholesaler retailer, would have more profit. And by the way, customers would get products more smoothly. So one example was the Walmart Procter & Gamble Alliance, which incorporated vendor-managed inventory. Procter & Gamble was allowed to manage their inventory for Walmart, their category management, and other intercompany innovations to increase the product flow efficiency. In fact, Procter & Gamble had a dedicated account team in Bentonville, Arkansas. What's important about Bentonville, Arkansas in the story? It's where Walmart is headquartered, right? So P&G out of Cincinnati picked up and put an actual team in Walmart's headquarters. The team members represented key P&G functions of sales and marketing, distribution, supply chain management, IT, and finance. And for that team, Walmart's CFO became a key customer. And P&G's objective became maximizing Walmart's internal profitability and doing everything they could do to make sure that product flowed smoothly, consistent with consumer demands. Within this system, we, of course, have channels of distribution. So we have marketing channels. Marketing channels consist of those individuals and firms involved in the process of making a product or service available for use or consumption by B2C consumers or B2B industrial users. And it's what has broken down during the pandemics, so it's important. Middlemen are part of this marketing channel. They are the business firms in a channel that render services directly related to the sale or purchase of a product as it flows from that producer out to the consumer. There's the middlemen, the intermediaries, and they're helping to assist all this to happen. So distribution's role within a marketing mix is to get the product to its target market at a reasonable cost, when they want it, in the right shape. So middlemen, wholesalers and retailers, can promote the product. They can store it. They can ship it. And they can assume some of the financial risk during the distribution process. So they have a variety of roles that they fulfill. We have two main type of, I'll use the word wholesalers here, but middlemen, merchant middlemen and agent middlemen. Middlemen are commonly classified on the basis of whether or not they take title to the products that are being distributed. Merchant middlemen take title to the products they help to market. Why do we care? Same reason as a few minutes ago. Who owns the product determines who has liability for theft, for damage, for late delivery to the ultimate consumer. But some people set themselves up as merchant middlemen. I'll buy your product, it's now mine, and I'll distribute it. Others, agent middlemen, I should have another thing there. Agent middlemen sell the product down the channel of distribution. They don't take title. So in essence, agent middlemen are sort of like a company's sales force. They take orders. They don't take ownership of the product. So we say you can eliminate the middleman, but you can't eliminate the essential distribution activities they perform. Somebody has to store the product, ship the product, promote the product. And if the middlemen don't do it, then either the manufacturer or maybe the retailer has to do it. Now, this has become an old and silly example. How many of you guys know Radiohead still? Radiohead is a band. So Radiohead ran an experiment a little bit ago that sort of cut out the middleman. So in the music industry, who's the middleman? The record label, the record company. And of course, there's always been a lot of complaint if you're in the music industry about how much they take and what they're doing and what they're not doing. Radiohead ran an interesting experiment a while ago. Do we have the details? So you remember Radiohead's experiment? I know you don't. In which they let people choose how much they wanted to pay for their latest album in rainbows. Call it a publicity stunt or an innovative business model, but the initial numbers show the experiment was a success. now that the final numbers were in. In short, In Rainbows sold better than their last albums, selling 1.75 million copies of the physical CD, 100,000 box set, 300,000 units on iTunes in the US in the first week of availability. The album was number one in both the UK and the US for the first 3 months. It was played 17 million times on last.fm, and even to whatever year this was, it's in the top 200 UK and US as far as the sales of physical CD goes. Yes, they're a big band. Yes, their audience is not the same as, say, Shakira's. Yes, this was one of the first such experiments, and it's caused a great deal of attention, regardless of the music. And the point is, they sort of cut out the middlemen, cut out the record label. And it was a shot over the bounds warning that record labels better pay attention to what services they're providing. But in general, we need the middlemen there. So let's look at some of these activities that the middlemen serve. They have transactional functions, logistical functions, and facilitating functions. And they sit in between the producers, the manufacturers, and the ultimate business consumer or the retailer. So here's the middlemen sitting here. For the manufacturer, they provide the facilitating function of providing market information. You're sitting in your manufacturing plant in St. Louis. What's going on in Akron, Ohio, relative to your product? Oh, well, how are you going to know? And by the way, you don't just sell in Akron. You sell in Akron and Buffalo and Pittsburgh and Miami. And how are you going to know that? Well, I suppose you could hire your own personal staff to go around to all these places and check things out. But what if your middleman, who was already going to move the product down there, gave you market information? Ooh, that's cool. They help to interpret consumer wants, the facilitating function. They can promote that producer's product down the channel, a transactional function. They can create assortment. Producers like to make huge runs of the same thing. Drives their unit cost down. But consumers don't want to buy a barrel full of screws. They want the little kit with the little screws, little nails, little hangers. So they do logistical by creating assortment. They store the product. They negotiate downstream with the customers in terms of price and shipping, etc. So the producer doesn't have to, a transactional function. They provide financing. So the producer isn't sitting there all the time that the product's in channel and warehouse waiting to be sold. So they can help finance a facilitating function. They can take over and own the product, as we just talked about, a facilitating function. And they share the risks, a transactional function. So the middleman does have some good things that are important to the producer. But they also do things for the buyer. So they can help the buyer to anticipate wants. They can help subdivide large quantities of product into smaller quantities of product. They can help to store the product. They can help to transport it, create assortments, provide financing, help to make the products readily available when consumers want it. They can help to guarantee products, and they can help to share the risks. So these functions for both sides of the equation help to justify the middleman and, of course, their profit, their markup. My silly example here is, without a middleman, who's been to the Kent stage to see a band or a group? Who'd you say? Do you remember? I don't know. All right. Radiohead. Let's pretend Radiohead played at the Kent stage. How would you get to hear Radiohead in Kent without the middleman? I suppose you get on the phone and call them up. Hi. Yeah, this is Dr. Marks up in marketing at Kent. I'd like to hear your band. Could you come to Kent and play for me? Well, that's stupid. That's not going to happen. So middlemen help you to get the product, the service, the band that you might want. So in this case, Kent Stage is helping to do those transactions for us. A distribution channel includes the people and firms involved in the transfer of title to a product as that product moves from the producer through the channel of distribution to the ultimate consumer or to the business user. We talked about why it's important to transfer that title financially, risk-wise. So here's the producer, here's the middleman, here's the final consumer or the business user. So we have a distribution channel going on here, transferring that title as it moves through that channel. The channel for a product extends only to the last person or the last organization that buys that thing without making any significant change in its form. When the form of the thing is altered and a new product emerges, then we have a new channel. Let's make a little bit of sense out of that. So we have a lumber mill. So a lumber mill produces raw wood, and their channel for lumber goes from a lumber mill through a middleman called a broker out to a furniture maker. Once the furniture maker gets it, it no longer comes out as raw lumber. That would be silly. Instead, the furniture maker changes the product into furniture. And so here we have Artistica Home, the furniture maker, selling out to a furniture store, Shadell, who sells to the final consumer. So one channel of distribution with title of the product at the top, it changes what it is into furniture, a second channel of distribution with the title to that product traveling through it. There are lots of other intermediaries. Banks help all these things to occur. They help with the financing. Insurance companies, once you own that product, you would like to be insured against liability. Transportation companies, there are a variety of these other intermediaries that help the whole thing to function properly. So we have different, in general, channels of distribution in the B2C versus the B2B world. So on the left-hand side, we see the consumer marketing channels. On the right-hand side, we see the business marketing channels. And through these channels, we're going to see flowing on the B2C and B2B side ownership of the product. Who owns it? When do they own it? When do they have responsibility for it? Payment for the product. Thank you very much. And information about the product, promotion of the product. In order to be a channel of distribution, you have to have at a minimum two things: a producer and a consumer, a buyer. Obviously, without those two things, you don't have much marketing going on. You don't have a channel of distribution. Now, in the situation we have only a producer and a buyer, producer and a consumer, that's called a direct channel. So sometimes we see DTC, direct to consumer, as an example. Just a couple examples I'm going to pop through in a minute. So let's think about a direct to consumer situation. So B2C or D2C. In this case, the producer to the consumer is a direct channel. We see it over here on the left-hand side. Lots of online companies are going to use that channel. 1-800-Flowers, a long time ago, was, before the internet, a place you would literally phone up. You'd phone them. They'd ship flowers to whoever you wanted. They were so successful as a business, they just made that their website. So there is a company called 1-800-Flowers.com, and you can call them up, and they'll ship flowers directly to your loved one. And I used to have a big box. I actually ordered some of that for my wife. She liked it. And they ship it in a big box. American Greetings Company, organic butter and cheese can be ordered directly online. Telephone sales can be direct to the consumer. Hard to do these days, but still. And some companies like Avon. Has anybody ever been to an Avon party? Of course not in the last couple of years. Anybody ever been to an Avon home party? Something like that. Or a Longaberger basket party? You've been to that sort of thing as well. Those folks work for the company, and they're selling directly in your home party to the consumer. During the COVID era, these folks have begun moving to Facebook, but they may still come back. So producer to consumer, a direct channel. A channel that has a producer, a final customer, and at least one intermediary is an indirect channel of distribution. So here we see Dell. Anybody ever gone online, bought a computer directly from Dell online? Yeah, so D2C, right? Direct to you from the manufacturer. But Dell will also sell their products to you through, for example, Walmart. So they are using an intermediary to sell that. If you're a business user, typically you're going to buy directly from Dell because you're buying a lot. So from the producer through a retailer to the consumer, like Walmart or Target, is a B2C indirect channel. The retailer has direct dealings with the producer because the retailer is big, and Walmart does that in a big way. as do other leading retailers such as Target. So we don't have a wholesaler here, we just have producer to the retailer to the consumer. Or we might interject a wholesaler. So producer to wholesaler, then to a retailer, and on to the consumer. If you're a big, big retailer, you have negotiating powers with the producers. You can work deals with them. If you're one of the thousands and thousands of small retail stores, how much negotiating power do you think you have? Not a lot. How much are they going to mess with you? You're going to buy 100 boxes of something. They don't even want to mess with you. The producers don't. What if we get a wholesaler that we work with? The wholesaler buys thousands of boxes and then distributes them locally to our small retailers. So this is really the only economical feasible way to market for thousands of small retailers. Producers to big area wholesalers, wholesalers to the retailers, out to the consumer. On the B2B side, the producer directly to a business consumer is the largest dollar volume of business of any other channel arrangement. Why is that true? Because in the business world, when you're buying something huge from a producer, jet engines, helicopters, elevators, you aren't going to your local retail store and buying that. These are massively expensive projects, products, and so this approach accounts for the largest dollar volume of business compared to any of the other channel arrangements. So, B2B direct. But we also have the idea of businesses going through, we don't call it a wholesaler on this side, we call it a business distributor to a business customer. So this indirect approach is often used for operating supplies, small accessory equipment. Anybody ever seen a Granger truck go around the area? If you're attuned to it periodically, you may actually notice the Granger truck going by. Granger is a business distributor. They have a catalog that includes a vast array of things to help local businesses. Motors, lighting, materials handling, fasteners, plumbing, tools, safety supplies. The revenue for this sort of intermediary is generally from business-to-business sales rather than consumer sales. And sometimes, indeed, you'll see the Granger truck driving around your area about to make some delivery to a local business customer. On the B2B side, we can have add another intermediary, a manufacturer's rep or a sales branch to a distributor, to a business customer. This indirect approach is often used by, I don't know what you is, by those who don't have the resources to call directly on their customers. A minute ago, we talked about the thousands of small retailers. How in the world are they going to do business with individual producers? Here we have thousands of little producers. How are they going to reach out to thousands of retailers, etc.? Well, they don't. They don't do it by themselves. They get manufacturers' reps. They get sales branches. Those sales branches or manufacturers' reps sign out to the business distributors, business wholesalers. And those folks sell out to the business customers, so a B2B indirect channel. And of course, we have digital marketing channels. So e-commerce, digital distribution, other internet age developments have added new ways to get products and services to consumers, B2C, B2B. Businesses can, and often do, operate both brick and mortar shops and online stores. Digital-only services may be downloaded directly from the provider or distributed through a value-added reseller. So we've gotten more complexity in the way that products and services can move to the ultimate consumer or the business consumer now that we have digital marketing going on. For example, the video game industry has shifted over the past 20 years. 20 years ago, consumers would have to travel to a physical store to buy games or use a mail order service. Anybody remember that long ago? Probably not. You do? Okay. So here is Atari, it's 20 years ago, selling its, I can't remember what example I had here, but it doesn't matter. Their game through GameStop or Babbage's. That's the way we bought our products, right? Today, then we moved along the internet, retailers started selling those products online. So the Sega Channel was an online game service developed by Sega for the Genesis video game console, serving as a content delivery system. Launched in 1994, the Sega Channel was provided to the public by TCI and Time Warner Cable through the cable television services by way of coax cable. Things change. The rise of e-commerce in markets like Amazon had another major distribution channel to account for. After following Bezos' initial business plan, the company expanded into selling computer games and music in 98. Selling electronics helped the company to grow rapidly and put traditional electronic stores like Circuit City. Anybody remember Circuit City? I think we talked about that one time before. They were the major competitor of Best Buy at the time. Out of business, so Amazon.com, 98, coming in with digital marketing. So with faster networks, gamers can cut out the middleman in physical media entirely by downloading video games through distribution services like Steam. How many of you guys use Steam today? Okay, that we got. Bricks and mortar stores, e-commerce retailers, and online shops still remain viable distribution channels. And video game companies need to factor all of that in as they think about how to reach that vast audience. How do they? Which channel do they focus on best? All right, I think that's plenty for today. We'll talk about omnichannel, multi-channel marketing next time, which would be Thursday. So don't forget, mini test 11 closes tonight. Midterm 2 closes tomorrow. Don't forget to do those things, please. Have a good day.